is Frommer imported a bunch of people who were not. The women at Carlin had a different look than the women at RBC, says another former RBC trader delicately. You got the feeling they were hired because they were hot. With Carlin also came a boiler room full of day traders, some of whom had rap sheets with various financial police, others of whom were about to wind up in jail for financial crimes. In the room was, among other people, Svi Goffer, who was later sentenced to 10 years in jail for orchestrating an insider trading ring in his prior job with the Galleon Group. Carlin was what I always imagined a bucket shop was like, says another former RBC trader. There was a lot of the gold chains attire, said another. It was as if a tribe of 1980s Wall Street alpha males had stumbled upon a time machine and, as a prank, identified the most mild-mannered, well-behaved province in Canada and teleported themselves into it. The RBC guys were at their desks at 6:30. The Carlin guys rolled in at 8:30 or so, looking distinctly unwell. The RBC guys were understated and polite. The Carlin guys were brash and loud. They lied or exaggerated a lot about their relationships with accounts, says a current RBC salesman. They were like, yeah, I cover hedge fund giant John Paulson, and we're tight. And you'd call Paulson up, and they'd barely heard of the guy. For reasons Brad did not fully grasp, RBC insisted that he move with his entire U.S. stock trading department from their offices near the World Trade Center site into Carlin's building in Midtown. This bothered him a lot. He got the distinct impression that people in Canada had decided that electronic trading was the future, even if they didn't understand why or even what it meant. Installed in Carlin's offices, the RBC people were soon gathered to hear a state of the financial markets address given by Frommer. He stood in front of a flat-panel computer monitor that hung on his wall. He gets up and says the markets are now all about speed, says Brad. Trading is all about speed. And then he says, I'm going to show you how fast our system is. He had this guy next to him with a computer keyboard. He said to him, enter an order. And the guy hit enter. And the order appeared on the screen so everyone could see it. And Frommer goes, see? See how fast that was? All the guy had done was type the name of a stock on a keyboard, and the name was displayed on the screen the way a letter, once it has been typed, appears on a computer screen. Then he goes, do it again. And the guy hits the enter button on the keyboard again. And everyone nods. It was 5 in the afternoon. The market wasn't open. Nothing was happening. But he was like, oh my God, it's happening in real time. And I was like, I don't fucking believe this. Brad thought, the guy who just sold us our new electronic trading platform either does not know that his display of technical virtuosity is absurd, or worse, he thinks we don't know. As it happened, at almost exactly the moment Jeremy Frommer fully entered Brad's life, the U.S. stock market began to behave oddly. Before RBC acquired this supposedly state-of-the-art electronic trading firm, his computers worked. Now suddenly, they didn't. Until he was forced to use some of Carlin's technology, he trusted his trading screens. When his trading screens showed 10,000 shares of Intel offered at $22 a share, it meant that he could buy 10,000 shares of Intel for $22 a share. He had only to push a button. By the spring of 2007, when his screen showed 10,000 shares of Intel offered at $22 and he pushed the button, the offers vanished. In his 7 years as a trader, He had always been able to look at the screens on his desk and see the stock market. Now, the market as it appeared on his screens was an illusion. This was a big problem. Brad's main role as a trader was to sit between investors who wanted to buy and sell big amounts of stock and the public markets, where the volumes were smaller. Some investor might want to sell a 3 million share block of IBM. The markets would only show demand for 1 million shares. Brad would buy the entire block, sell off 1 million shares of it instantly, and then work artfully over the next few hours to unload the other 2 million shares. If he didn't know what the markets actually were, he couldn't price the larger block. He had been supplying liquidity to the market. Now, whatever was happening on his screens was reducing his willingness to do it. Unable to judge market risks, he was less happy to take them. By June 2007, the problem had grown too big to ignore. An electronics company in Singapore called Flextronics announced its intention to buy a smaller rival, Selectron, for a bit less than $4 a share. A big investor called Brad and said he wanted to sell 5 million shares of Selectron. The public stock markets, the New York Stock Exchange, NYSE, and NASDAQ, showed the current market. Say it was 370 to 375. Which is to say you could sell Selectron for $3.70 a share or buy it for $3.75. The problem was that at those prices, only 1 million shares were bid for and offered. The big investor who wished to sell 5 million shares of Selectron called Brad because he wanted Brad to take the risk on the other 4 million shares. And so Brad bought the shares at $3.65, slightly below the price quoted in the public markets. But when he turned to the public markets, the markets on his trading screens, the share price instantly moved, almost as if the market had read his mind. Instead of selling 1 million shares at $3.70, as he'd assumed he could do, he sold a few hundred thousand and triggered a mini collapse in the price of Selectron. It was as if someone knew what he was trying to do and was reacting to his desire to sell before he had fully expressed it. By the time he was done selling all 5 million shares at prices far below $3.70, he had lost a small fortune. This made no sense to him. He understood how he might move the price of an infrequently traded stock simply by satisfying the demand for the highest bidder. But in the case of Selectron, the stock of a company about to be taken over at a known price by another company, was trading heavily. There should be plenty of supply and demand in a very narrow price range. It just shouldn't move very much. The buyers in the market shouldn't vanish the moment he sought to sell. At that point, he did what most people do when they don't understand why their computer isn't working the way it's supposed to. He called tech support. If your keyboard didn't work, these were the guys who would come up and replace it. Like tech support everywhere, their first assumption was that Brad didn't know what he was doing. User error was the thing they'd throw at you. They just thought of us traders as a bunch of dumb jocks. He explained to them that all he was doing was hitting the enter key on his keyboard. It was hard to screw that up. Once it was clear that the problem was more complicated than user error, the troubleshooting was bumped to a higher level. They started to send me product people, the people who had bought and installed the systems, and they at least sort of sounded like technologists. He explained that the market on his screens used to be a fair representation of the actual stock market, but that now it was not. In return, he received mainly blank stares. It wound up being me talking to someone and them looking, like, befuddled. Finally, he complained so loudly that they sent him the developers, the guys who had come to RBC in the Carlin acquisition. We would hear how they had this room full of Indians and Chinese guys. Rarely would you see them on the trading floor. They were called the Golden Goose. The bank did not want the Golden Goose distracted, and when the geese arrived, they had the air of people on leave from some critical mission. They, too, explained to Brad that he, and not his machine, was the problem. They told me it was because I was in New York and the markets were in New Jersey, and my market data was slow. Then they said that it was all caused by the fact that there are thousands of people trading in the market. They'd say, "You aren't the only one trying to do what you're trying to do. There's other events. There's news." If that was the case, he asked them, why did the market in any given stock dry up only when he was trying to trade in it? To make his point, he asked the developers to stand behind him and watch while he traded. I'd say, "Watch closely. I'm about to buy 100,000 shares of Amgen. I am willing to pay $48 a share. There are currently 100,000 shares of Amgen being offered at $48 a share, 10,000 on BATS, 35,000 on the New York Stock Exchange, 30,000 on NASDAQ, and 25,000 on Direct Edge." You could see it all on the screens. We'd all sit there and stare at the screen, and I'd have my finger over the enter button. I'd count out loud to five. One, two, see, nothing's happened. Three, offers are still there at 48. Four, still no movement. Five. Then I'd hit the enter button, and boom, all hell would break loose. The offerings would all disappear, and the stock would pop higher. At which point he turned to the guys standing behind him and said, "You see, I'm the event. I am the news." To that, the developers had no response. They were kind of like, "Oh, yeah, let me look into that." Then they'd disappear and never come back. He called a few times, but when I realized they really had no shot at solving the problem, I just left them alone. Brad suspected that the culprit was the technology from Carlin that RBC had more or less bolted onto the side of his trading machines. "As the market problem got worse," he said, "I started to just assume my real problem was with how bad their technology was." A pattern was established. The moment he attempted to react to the market on his screens, the market moved. And it wasn't just him. The exact same thing was happening to all of the RBC stock market traders who worked for him. In addition, for reasons he couldn't fathom, the fees that RBC was paying to stock exchanges were suddenly skyrocketing. At the end of 2007, Brad conducted a study to compare what had happened on his trading books to what should have happened, or what used to happen, when the stock market, as stated on his trading screens, was the market he experienced. The difference to us was tens of millions of dollars in losses plus fees, he said. We were hemorrhaging money. His bosses in Toronto called him in and told him to figure out how to reduce his rising trading costs. Up till then, Brad had taken the stock exchanges for granted. When he had arrived in New York in 2002, 85% of all stock market trading happened on the New York Stock Exchange, and some human being processed every order. The stocks that didn't trade on the New York Stock Exchange traded on NASDAQ. No stocks traded on both exchanges. At the behest of the SEC, in turn responding to public protests about cronyism, the exchanges themselves in 2005 went from being utilities owned by their members to public corporations run for profit. Once competition was introduced, the exchanges multiplied. By early 2008, there were 13 different public exchanges, most of them in northern New Jersey. Virtually every stock now traded on all of these exchanges. You could still buy and sell IBM on the New York Stock Exchange, but you could also buy and sell it on BATS, Direct Edge, NASDAQ, NASDAQ BX, and so on. The idea that a human being needed to stand between investors and the market was dead. The exchange at NASDAQ, or at the New York Stock Exchange, or at their new competitors such as BATS and Direct Edge, was a stack of computer servers that contained the program called the matching engine. There was no one inside the exchange to talk to. You submitted an order to the exchange by typing it into a computer and sending it into the exchange's matching engine. At the big Wall Street banks, the guys who once peddled stocks to big investors had been reprogrammed. They now sold algorithms, or encoded trading rules designed by the banks that investors used to submit their stock market orders. The departments that created these trading algorithms were dubbed electronic trading. That was why the Royal Bank of Canada had panicked and bought Carlin. There was still a role for Brad and traders like Brad to sit between buyers and sellers of giant blocks of stock and the market, but the space was shrinking. At the same time, the exchanges were changing the way they made money. In 2002, they charged every Wall Street broker who submitted a stock market order the same simple fixed commission per share traded. Replacing people with machines enabled the markets to become not just faster, but more complicated. The exchanges rolled out an incredibly complicated system of fees and kickbacks. The system was called the maker-taker model, and like a lot of Wall Street creations, was understood by almost no one. Even professional investors' eyes glazed over when Brad tried to explain it to them. "It was the one thing I'd skip, because a lot of people just didn't get it," he said. Say you wanted to buy shares in Apple, and the market in Apple was 400 to 400.05. If you simply went in and bought the shares at $400.05, you were said to be crossing the spread. The trader who crossed the spread was classified as the taker. If you instead rested your order to buy Apple at $400 and someone came along and sold the shares to you at $400, you were designated a maker. In general, the exchanges charged takers a few pennies a share, paid makers somewhat less, and pocketed the difference, on the dubious theory that whoever resisted the urge to cross the spread was performing some kind of service. But there were exceptions. For instance, the BATS exchange in Weehawken, New Jersey, perversely paid takers and charged makers. In early 2008, all of this came as news to Brad Katsuyama. "I thought all the exchanges just charged us a flat fee," he said. "I'm like, holy shit, you mean someone will pay us to trade?" Thinking he was being clever, he had all of RBC's trading algorithms direct the bank's stock market orders to whatever exchange would pay them the most for what they wanted to do, which at that moment happened to be the BATS exchange. "It was a total disaster," said Brad. When he tried to buy or sell stock and seize the payment from the BATS exchange, the market for that stock simply vanished, and the price of the stock moved away from him. Instead of being paid, he wound up hemorrhaging even more money. It was not obvious to Brad why some exchanges paid you to be a taker and charged you to be a maker, while others charged you to be a taker and paid you to be a maker. No one he asked could explain it, either. It wasn't like there was anyone saying, "Hey, you should really be paying attention to this," because no one was paying attention to this. To further bewilder the Wall Street brokers who sent stock market orders to the exchanges, the amounts that were charged varied from exchange to exchange, and the exchanges often changed their pricing. To Brad, this all just seemed bizarre and unnecessarily complicated, and it raised all sorts of questions. Why would you pay anyone to be a taker? I mean, who is willing to pay to make a market? Why would anyone do that? He took to asking people around the bank who might know more than he did. He tried Googling, but there wasn't really anything to Google. One day he was talking to a guy who worked on the retail end in Toronto, selling stocks to individual Canadians. I said, "I'm getting screwed, but I can't figure out who is screwing me." And he says, "You know, there are more players out there in the market now." And I say, "What do you mean, more players?" He says, "You know, there's this new firm that's now 10% of the U.S. market." The guy mentioned the firm's name, but Brad didn't fully catch it. It sounded like Gecko. The name was Getco. I'd never even heard of Getco. I didn't even know the name. I'm like, what? They were 10% of the market? How can that be true? It's insane that someone could be 10% of the U.S. stock market, and I'm running a Wall Street trading desk, and I've never heard of the place. And why, he wondered, would a guy from retail in Canada know about them first? He was now running a stock market trading department, unable to trade properly in the U.S. stock market. He was forced to watch people he cared for harassed and upset by a bunch of 1980s Wall Street throwbacks. And then, in the fall of 2008, as he sat and wondered what else might go wrong, the entire U.S. financial system went into a freefall. The way Americans handled their money had led to market chaos, and the market chaos created life chaos. The jobs and careers of everyone around him were suddenly on the line. Every day I'd walk home and feel as if I had just got hit by a car. He wasn't naive. He knew that there were good guys and bad guys, and that sometimes the bad guys win. But he also believed that usually they did not. That view was now challenged. When he began to grasp, along with the rest of the world, what big American firms had done, rigged credit ratings to make bad loans seem like good loans, created subprime bonds designed to fail, sold them to their customers, and then bet against them and so on, his mind hit some kind of wall. For the first time in his career, he felt that he could only win if someone else lost. Or more likely, that someone else could only win if he lost. He was not by nature a zero-sum person, but he had somehow wound up in the middle of a zero-sum business. His body had always tended to register stress before his mind. It was as if his mind refused to accept the possibility of conflict, even as his body was engaged in that conflict. Now he bounced from one illness to another. His sinuses became infected and required surgery. His blood pressure, chronically high, skyrocketed. His doctors had him seeing a kidney specialist. By early 2009, he had decided to quit Wall Street. He'd just become engaged. After work every day, he'd sit down with his fiancée, Ashley Hooper, a recent Ole Miss graduate who'd grown up in Jacksonville, Florida, to decide where to live. They'd whittled the list down to San Diego, Atlanta, Toronto, Orlando, and San Francisco. He had no idea what he was going to do. He just wanted out. "I thought I could just sell pharmaceuticals or whatever." He'd never felt a need to be on Wall Street. It was never a calling, he said. "I didn't think about money or the stock market when I was growing up, so the attachment was not strong." Maybe more oddly, he hadn't become all that wedded to money, even though RBC was now paying him almost $2 million a year. His heart had been in his job, but mainly because he really liked the people he worked for and the people who worked for him. What he liked about RBC was that it had never pressured him to be anyone but himself. The bank, or the markets, or perhaps both, was now pushing him to be someone else. Then the bank, on its own, changed its mind. In February 2009, RBC parted ways with Jeremy Frommer and asked Brad to help find someone to replace him. Even as he had one foot out the door, Brad found himself interviewing candidates from all over Wall Street. And he saw that basically none of the people who held themselves out as knowledgeable about electronic trading understood it. The problem was that the electronic people facing clients were just front men, he said. They had no clue how the technology worked. He withdrew his foot from the doorway and thought about it. Every day the markets were driven less directly by human beings and more directly by machines. The machines were overseen by people, of course, but few of them knew how the machines worked. He knew that RBC's machines, not the computers themselves, but the instructions to run them, were third rate, but he had assumed it was because the company's new electronic trading unit was bumbling and inept. As he interviewed people from the major banks on Wall Street, he came to realize that they had more in common with RBC than he had supposed. "I'd always been a trader," he said, "and as a trader, you're kind of inside a bubble. You're just watching your screens all day. Now I step back and for the first time started to watch other traders." He had a good friend who traded stocks at a big-time hedge fund in Greenwich, Connecticut, called SAC Capital. SAC Capital was famous, and soon to be infamous, for being one step ahead of the U.S. stock market. If anyone was going to know something about the market that Brad didn't know, he figured it would be them. One spring morning, he took the train up to Greenwich and spent the day watching his friend trade. Right away, he saw that even though his friend was using technology given to him by Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and the other big firms, he was experiencing exactly the same problem as RBC. The market on his screens was no longer the market. His friend would hit a button to buy or sell a stock, and the market would move away from him. "When I see this guy trading and he was getting screwed, I now see that it isn't just me. My frustration is the market's frustration." And I was like, "Whoa, this is serious." Brad's problem wasn't just Brad's problem. What people saw when they looked at the U.S. stock market, the numbers on the screens of the professional traders, the ticker tape running across the bottom of the CNBC screen, was an illusion. "That's when I realized the markets are rigged, and I knew it had to do with the technology, that the answer lay beneath the surface of the technology. I had absolutely no idea where, but that's when the light bulb went off, that the only way I'm going to find out what's going on is if I go beneath the surface." There was no way he, Brad Katsuyama, was going to go below the surface of the technology. People always assumed, because he was an Asian male, that he must be a computer wizard. He couldn't, or wouldn't, program his own VCR. What he had was an ability to distinguish between computer people who didn't actually know what they were talking about and those who did. The very best example of the latter, he thought, was Rob Park. Park, a fellow Canadian, was a legend at RBC. In college in the late 1990s, he had become entranced by what was then a novel idea, to teach a machine to behave like a very smart trader. "The thing that interested me was taking a trader's thought process and replicating it," Park said. He and Brad had worked together at RBC only briefly back in 2004, before he left to start his own business, but they had hit it off. Rob took an interest in the way Brad thought when he traded. Rob then turned those thoughts into code. The result was RBC's most popular trading algorithm. Here's how it worked. Say the trader wanted to buy 100,000 shares in General Motors. The algo scanned the market. It saw that there were only 100 shares offered. No smart trader seeking to buy 100,000 shares would tip his desire for a mere 100 shares. The market was too thin. But what was the point at which the trader should buy GM stock? The algorithm Rob built had a trigger point. It only bought stock if the amount on offer was greater than the historical average of the amount offered. That is, if the market was thick. The decision he makes makes sense, Brad said of Rob. He puts an incredible amount of thought into them. And since he puts so much thought into his decisions, he's capable of explaining those decisions to others. After Brad persuaded Rob to return to RBC, he had the perfect person to figure out what had happened to the U.S. stock market. And in Brad, Rob saw the perfect person to grasp and explain to others whatever he discovered. All Brad needs is a translator from computer language to human language, said Park. Once he has a translator, he completely understands it. Brad wasn't exactly shocked when RBC finally gave up looking for someone to run its mess of an electronic trading operation and asked him if he would take over and fix it. Everyone else was shocked when he agreed to do it, as A, he had a safe and cushy $2 million a year job running the human traders, and B, RBC had nothing to add to electronic trading. The market was cluttered. Big investors had only so much space on their desks for trading algorithms sold by brokers, and Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and Credit Suisse had long since overrun that space and colonized it. All that was left of RBC's purchase of Carlin was the Golden Goose. Thus, Brad's first question to the Golden Goose, how do we plan to make money? They had an answer. They planned to open RBC's first dark pool. That, as it turned out, was what the Golden Goose had been up to all along, writing the software for the dark pool. Dark pools were another rogue spawn of the new financial marketplace. Private stock exchanges, run by the big brokers, they were not required to reveal to the public what happened inside them. They reported any trade they executed, but they did so with sufficient delay that it was impossible to know exactly what was happening in the broader market at the moment the trade occurred. Their internal rules were a mystery, and only the broker who ran a dark pool knew for sure whose buy and sell orders were allowed inside. The amazing idea the big Wall Street banks had sold to big investors was that transparency was their enemy. If, say, Fidelity wanted to sell 1 million shares of Microsoft Corp., so the argument ran, they were better off putting them into a dark pool run by, say, Credit Suisse, than going directly to the public exchanges. On the public exchanges, everyone would notice a big seller had entered the market, and the market price of Microsoft would plunge. Inside a dark pool, no one but the broker who ran it had any idea what was happening. The cost of RBC's creating and running its own dark pool, Brad now learned, would be nearly $4 million a year. Thus his second question for the Golden Goose, how will we make more than $4 million from our own dark pool? The Golden Goose explained that they'd save all sorts of money in fees they paid to the public exchanges by putting together buyers and sellers of the same stocks who came to RBC at the same time. If RBC had some investor who wanted to buy 1 million shares of Microsoft and another who wanted to sell 1 million shares of Microsoft, they could simply pair them off in the dark pool rather than pay NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange to do it. In theory, this made sense. In practice, not so much. The problem, said Brad, was RBC was 2% of the market. I asked how often we were likely to have buyers and sellers to cross. No one had done the analysis. The analysis once finished showed that RBC, if it opened a dark pool and routed all its clients' orders into it first, would save about $200,000 a year in exchange fees. So I said, "Okay, how else will we make money?" The answer that came back explained why no one had bothered to do any analysis on dark pools in the first place. There was a lot of free money to be made, the computer programmers explained, by selling access to the RBC dark pool to outside traders. They said there were all these people who will pay to be in our dark pool, recalled Brad. And I said, "Who would pay to be in our dark pool?" And they said, "High-frequency traders." Brad tried to think of good reasons why traders of any sort would pay RBC for access to RBC's customers' stock market orders, but he came up with none. "It just felt weird," he said. "I had a feeling of why, and the feeling didn't feel good, so I said, 'Okay, none of this sounds like a good idea. Kill the dark pool.'" That just pissed off a lot of people and fueled suspicions that Brad Katsuyama was engaged in some activity other than the search for corporate profits. Now he was in charge of a business called electronic trading with nothing to sell. What he had instead was a fast-growing pile of unanswered questions. Why, between the dark pools and the public exchanges, were there nearly 60 different places, most of them in New Jersey, where you could buy any listed stock? Why did the public exchanges fiddle with their own pricing so often? And why did you get paid by one exchange to do exactly the same thing for which another exchange might charge you? How did a firm he'd never heard of, Getco, trade 10% of the entire volume of the stock market? How had this guy in the middle of nowhere, in retail in Canada, learned of Getco's existence before him? Why was the market displayed on Wall Street trading screens an illusion? In May 2009, what appeared to be a scandal involving the public stock exchanges added more questions to Brad's list. New York Senator Charles Schumer wrote a letter to the SEC, then issued a press release telling the world what he had done, condemning the stock exchanges for allowing sophisticated, high-frequency traders to gain access to trading information before it is sent out widely to other traders. For a fee, the exchange will flash information about buy and sell orders for just a few fractions of a second before the information is made publicly available. That was the first time that Brad had heard the term flash orders. To the growing list of mental questions, he added another. Why would stock exchanges have allowed flash trading in the first place? He and Rob set out to build a team of people to investigate the U.S. stock market. "At first, I was looking for guys who had worked in HFT, high-frequency trading, or who had worked at large banks," said Brad. No one who had worked in high-frequency trading would return his calls. Finding people who work for the big banks was easier. Wall Street firms were shedding people. Guys who wouldn't have given RBC a second thought were now turning up in his office begging for work. "I interviewed more than 75 people," he said. "We didn't hire any of them." The problem with all of these people was that even when they said they had worked in electronic trading, they clearly didn't understand how the electronics did the trading. Instead of waiting for resumes to find him, Brad went looking for people who worked in or near the bank's technology departments. In the end, his new team consisted of a former Deutsche Bank software programmer named Billy Zhao, a former manager in Bank of America's electronic trading division named John Schwall, and a 22-year-old recent Stanford computer science graduate named Dan Eisen. He then set out with Rob for Princeton, New Jersey, where the Golden Goose resided, to figure out if any pieces of the goose were worth keeping. There they found a Chinese programmer named Alan Zhang, who it turned out had written the computer code for the doomed dark pool. "I couldn't tell who was good and who was not from just talking to them, but Rob could," said Brad, and it became clear that Alan was the goose. or at any rate the only part of the goose that might be turned to gold. Alan, Brad noticed, had no interest in conforming to the norms of corporate life. He preferred to work on his own, in the middle of the night, and refused to ever take off his baseball cap, which he wore pulled down low over his eyes, giving him the appearance of a getaway driver badly in need of sleep. Alan was also incomprehensible. What was just possibly English came tumbling out of him so quickly and indistinctly that his words tended to freeze the listener in his tracks. As Brad put it, whenever Alan said anything, I'd turn to Rob and say, "What the fuck did he just say?" Once he had a team in place, Brad persuaded his superiors at the Royal Bank of Canada to conduct what amounted to a series of science experiments in the U.S. stock markets. For the next several months, he and his team would trade stocks not to make money, but to test theories, to try to answer his original question. Why was there a difference between the stock market displayed on his trading screens and the actual market? Why, when he went to buy 20,000 shares of IBM offered on his trading screens, did the market only sell him 2,000? To search for an answer, RBC agreed to let his team lose up to $10,000 a day. Brad asked Rob to come up with some theories to spend the money on. The obvious place to start was the public markets, the 13 stock exchanges scattered in 4 different sites run by the New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, BATS, and Direct Edge. Rob invited the exchanges to send representatives to RBC to answer a few questions. We were asking really basic questions. How does your matching engine work, recalls Park? How does it handle a lot of different orders at the same price? But they sent salespeople, and they had no idea. When we kept pushing, they sent product managers, business people who knew a little about the technology, but they really didn't know much. They finally sent developers. They were the guys who actually programmed the machines. The question we wanted to answer was, what happens between the time you push the button to trade and the time your order gets to the exchange, says Park. People think pushing a button is as simple as pushing a button. It's not. All these things have to happen. There's a ton of stuff happening. The data we got from them about what was happening at first just seemed random. But we knew the answer was out there. It was just a question of how to find it. Rob's first theory was that the exchanges weren't simply bundling all the orders at a given price, but arranging them in some kind of sequence. You and I might both submit an order to buy 1,000 shares of IBM at $30 a share, but you might somehow obtain the right to cancel your order if my order is filled. We started getting the idea that people were canceling orders, says Park, that they were just phantom orders. Say the markets together showed 10,000 shares of Apple offered at $400 a share. Typically, that didn't represent one person who wanted to sell 10,000 shares of Apple, but rather a bunch of smaller sell orders lumped together. They suspected that the orders were lined up in such a way that some people at the back of the line had the ability to jump out of the queue the moment the people in the front of the line sold their shares. We tried calling the exchanges and asking them if that's what they did, said Park. But we didn't even know what words to use. The further problem was that the trading reports did not separate out the exchanges. If you tried to buy 10,000 shares of Apple that seemed to be on offer and succeeded in buying only 2,000 of them, you weren't informed which exchanges the 8,000 missing shares had vanished from. Alan wrote a new program that allowed Brad to send orders to a single exchange. Brad was fairly certain that this would prove that some, or maybe even all, of the exchanges were allowing these phantom orders. But no. When he sent an order to a single exchange, he was able to buy everything on offer. The market, as it appeared on his screens, was, once again, the market. I thought, crap, there goes that theory, said Brad. and that's our only theory. It made no sense. Why would the market on the screens be real if you sent your order only to one exchange, but prove illusory when you sent your order to all the exchanges at once? Lacking an actual theory, Brad's team began to send orders into various combinations of exchanges. First, NYSE and NASDAQ, then NYSE and NASDAQ and BATS, then NYSE, NASDAQ, BX, NASDAQ, and BATS, and so on. What came back was a further mystery. As they increased the number of exchanges, the percentage of the order that was filled decreased. The more places they tried to buy stock from, the less stock they actually bought. There was one exception, said Brad. No matter how many exchanges we sent an order to, we always got 100% of what was offered on BATS. Rob Park studied this and said, I had no idea why this would be. I just thought, BATS is a great exchange. One morning, while taking a shower, Rob had another theory. He was picturing a bar chart Alan had created. It showed the time it took orders to travel from Brad's trading desk in the World Financial Center to the various exchanges. To widespread relief, they'd left Carlin's old offices and moved back downtown. I was just visualizing that chart, he said. It just occurred to me that the bars were different heights. What if they were the same height? That got me fired up immediately. I went to work and went right to Brad's office and said, I think it's because we're not arriving at the same time. The increments of time involved were absurdly small. In theory, the shortest travel time from Brad's desk to the BATS exchange in Weehawken was about 2 milliseconds, and the slowest from Brad's desk to Carteret was around 4 milliseconds. In practice, the times could vary much more than that, depending on network traffic, static, and glitches in the pieces of equipment between any two points. It took 100 milliseconds to blink your eyes. It was hard to believe that a fraction of the blink of an eye could have such vast market consequences. Alan wrote a program, this one took him a couple of days, that built delays into the orders Brad sent to exchanges that were faster to get to, so that they arrived at exactly the same time as they did at the exchanges that were slower to get to. It was counterintuitive, says Park, because everyone was telling us it was all about faster, we had to go faster, and we were slowing it down. One morning, they sat down at the screen to test the program. Ordinarily, when you hit the button to buy and failed to get the stock, the screens lit up red. When you got only some of the stock you were after, the screens lit up brown. And when you got everything you asked for, the screens lit up green. Alan hadn't taken his Series 7 exam, which meant he wasn't allowed to press the enter button and make a trade, so Rob actually hit the button. Alan watched the screens light up green, and as he later said, I had the thought, this is too easy. Rob did not agree. As soon as I pushed the button, I ran to Brad's desk, recalled Rob. It worked. It fucking worked. I remember there was a pause, and then Brad said, now what do we do? That question implied an understanding. Someone out there was using the fact that stock market orders arrived at different times at different exchanges to front-run orders from one market to another. Knowing that, what do you do next? That question suggested another. Do you use this knowledge to join whatever game is being played in the stock market, or for some other purpose? It took Brad roughly 6 seconds to answer the question. Brad said, we have to go on an educational campaign, recalls Park. It would have been very easy to make money off this. He just chose not to. They now had an answer to one of their questions, which, as always, raised another question. It's 2009. said Brad. This had been happening to me for almost 3 years. There's no way I'm the first guy to have figured this out. So what's happened to everyone else? They also had a tool they could sell to investors, the program Alan had written to build delays into the stock exchange orders. Before they did that, they wanted to test it on RBC's own traders. I remember being at my desk, said Park, and you hear people going, "Oh," and "Holy shit, you can buy stock." The tool enabled the traders to do the job they were meant to do, take risk on behalf of the big investors who wanted to trade big chunks of stock. They could once again trust the market on their screens. The tool needed a name. Brad and his team stewed over this until one day a trader stood up at his desk and hollered, "Dude, you should just call it Thor, the hammer." Someone was assigned to figure out what Thor might be an acronym for, and they found some words that worked, but no one remembered them. The tool was always just Thor. "I knew we were onto something when Thor became a verb," said Brad, "when I heard guys shouting, 'Thor it!'" The other way he knew they were onto something was from conversations he had with a few of the world's biggest money managers. The first visit Brad and Rob Park made was to Mike Gitlin, who oversaw $700 billion in U.S. stock market investments for T. Rowe Price. The story they told didn't come to Gitlin as a complete shock. "You could see that something had just changed," said Gitlin. "You could see that when you were trading a stock, the market knew what you were going to do, and it was going to move against you." But what Brad described was a far more detailed picture of the market than Gitlin had ever considered. And in that market, all the incentives were screwed up. The Wall Street brokerage firm deciding where to send T. Rowe Price's buy and sell orders had a great deal of power over how and where those orders got submitted. The firms were now paid for sending orders to some exchanges and billed for sending orders to others. Did the broker resist these incentives when they didn't align with the interests of the investors he was meant to represent? No one could say. Another wacky incentive was called payment for order flow. As of 2010, every American stockbroker and all the online brokers effectively auction their customers' stock market orders. The online broker TD Ameritrade, for example, was paid hundreds of millions of dollars each year to send their orders to a high-frequency trading firm called Citadel, which executed the orders on their behalf. Why was Citadel willing to pay so much to see the flow? No one could say with certainty. It had been hard to measure the cost of the new market structure, but now there was a tool for gauging not just how orders reached their destination, but also how much money this new Wall Street intermediation machine was removing from the pockets of investors, large and small. Thor. Brad explained to Mike Gitlin how his team had placed big trades to measure how much more cheaply they bought stock when they removed the ability of the machine to front-run them. For instance, they bought 10 million shares of Citigroup, then trading at roughly $4 per share, and saved $29,000, or less than a tenth of 1% of the total price. "That was the tax," said Rob Park. It sounded small until you realize that the average daily volume in the U.S. stock market was $225 billion. The same tax rate applied to that sum came to more than $160 million a day. "It was so insidious because you couldn't see it," said Brad. "It happens on such a granular level that even if you tried to line it up and figure it out, you wouldn't be able to do it. People are getting screwed because they can't imagine a microsecond." Thor showed you what happened when a Wall Street firm helped an investor to avoid paying the tax. The evidence was indirect, but to Gitlin's mind, damning. The mere existence of Brad Katsuyama was totally shocking. To have RBC have the foremost electronic trading expert in the world was a little strange, said Gitlin. You would not think that is where the world's foremost electronic expert would reside. The discovery of Thor was not the end of a story. It was closer to a beginning. Brad and his team were building a mental picture of the financial markets after the crisis. The market was now a pure abstraction. It called to mind no obvious picture to replace the old one that people still carried around in their heads. The same old ticker tape ran across the bottom of television screens, even though it represented only a tiny fraction of the actual trading. Market experts still reported from the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, even though trading no longer happened there. For a market expert truly to get inside the New York Stock Exchange, he'd need to climb inside a tall black stack of computer servers locked inside a cage, locked inside a fortress, guarded by a small army of heavily armed men and touchy German shepherds in Mahwah, New Jersey. If he wanted an overview of the entire stock market, or even the trading in a single company like IBM, he'd need to inspect the computer printouts from 12 other public exchanges scattered across northern New Jersey, plus records of the private dealings that occurred inside the growing number of dark pools. If he tried to do this, he'd soon learn that there actually was no computer printout. At least no reliable one. No mental picture existed of the new financial market. There was only this yellowing photograph of a market now dead that served as a stand-in for the living. Brad had no idea how dark and difficult the picture he'd create would become. All he knew for sure was that the stock market was no longer a market. It was a collection of small markets scattered across New Jersey and lower Manhattan. When bids and offers for shares sent to these places arrived at precisely the same moment, the markets acted as markets should. If they arrived even a millisecond apart, the market vanished, and all bets were off. Brad knew that he was being front-run, that some other trader was in effect noticing his demand for stock on one exchange and buying it on others in anticipation of selling it to him at a higher price. He'd identified a suspect, high-frequency traders. I had a sense that the problems are being caused by this new participant in the market, said Brad. I just didn't know how they were doing it. By late 2009, U.S. high-frequency trading firms were flying to Toronto with offers to pay Canadian banks to expose their customers to high-frequency traders. Earlier that year, one of RBC's competitors, the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce, CIBC, had sublet its license on the Toronto Stock Exchange to several high-frequency trading firms, and within a few months, had seen its historically stable 6-7% share of Canadian stock market trading triple. The rules of the Canadian stock market are different than the rules of the U.S. stock market. One rule in Canada that does not exist in the United States is broker priority. The idea is to enable brokerage firms that have both sides of a trade to pair off buyers and sellers without the interference of other buyers and sellers. For example, imagine that CIBC, representing some investor, has a standing order to buy shares in Company X at $20 a share, but that it is not alone, and several other banks also have standing orders for Company X's shares at $20. If CIBC then enters the market with an order from another CIBC customer to sell shares in Company X at $20, the CIBC buyer has priority on the trade and is the first to have his order filled. By allowing high-frequency traders to operate with CIBC's license, CIBC was, in effect, creating lots of collisions between its own customers and the HFT firms. Senior managers at the Royal Bank of Canada were now arguing that the bank should create a Canadian dark pool, route their Canadian customers' stock market orders into it, and then sell to high-frequency traders the rights to operate inside the dark pool. Brad thought that it made a lot more sense for RBC simply to expose the new game for what it was, and perhaps establish themselves as the only broker on Wall Street not conspiring to screw investors. The only card left